You're invited, though, that the university has come through with payment on its own. And we should pause a moment to thank the man most responsible for carrying through, Father John Culkin. Father, would you stand up and take a bow? One more thing which might make Dr. McLuhan slightly more understandable. He is a Texan by marriage. His wife is from Fort Worth. And now it gives me pleasure to introduce our seeing eye dog for the day, Dr. Ralph Baldwin, who will be followed by Dr. McLuhan on the topic, open mind surgery. Dr. Baldwin.
Thank you, Ralph. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Jacobs. It's good to be here with all of you, although I can't profess that this is the very moment I've been waiting for. I'm very indebted to Steve Allen for an observation he made a long time ago. The funny man is a man with a grievance. I tried that one backwards and said, all right, then where there are grievances, there should be lots of jokes. And mostly it proves that way. In French Canada, there are lots of grievances, and you remember how General de Gaulle offered to free French Canada recently? He offered to free the Scots, too. That didn't make the press quite as excited as it should have. He didn't dream of freeing the Irish. I think there would have been a storm. But de Gaulle is, you know, a nous la liberté, huh? But as a result of paying attention to grievances, I've discovered to make quite a batch of jokes, and I pay special attention to media jokes, like the one of the teachers speaking to a class and saying, now, class, what does this century owe most to Thomas Edison? And a hand went up and said, teacher, if it weren't for Thomas Edison, we would be watching TV by candlelight. The French Canadians revel in jokes like the one about the president of Canadian Shell chatting on the phone with the president of American Shell a couple of years hence. And the Canadian president is saying vehemently, and we must have a big personnel program in Sherbrooke and a total reorganization of the whole show to suite. And there's a pause, and a voice from the American end says, hey, who the heck you think you're talking to, white boy? It was quite recently that I began to pay a little attention to the effect of radio on the 20s. And as you know, it brought in the jazz age and the jazz babies. It brought in Hitler. That is, Hitler is a man who played it by ear and who was a retribalized man who had a new message to offer to the Germans by way of their regaining their tribal identity. The other night, the CBS show on Germany was terrifying. It revealed that the Germans are desperately seeking for a new tribal identity. It was Ray Bradbury who pointed out, maybe others too, but I just happened to hear him say this, violence is the quest for identity. And whether you do it a la John Wayne or a la Negro riots, whether you do it individually or corporately, the quest for identity can only be satisfied by violence. It doesn't have to be punch in the face. It can be a violence one does to one's own nature. self-discipline, asceticism, and so on, also forms of violence. But the 20s, having become alienated from the visual world of goals and simple directions, began to live it up. They got turned on and they began to live it up in the jazz age. That turned the Negroes on. It was one of their great moments. Not as great as their TV moment by any means. But the coming of this new tribal mentality to the 1920s inspired Gertrude Stein to point out to her group, her age group, you are all a lost generation. This is the condition of the 21s and over right now. Lost generation because they were too old to tribalize, to get the jazz baby message of involvement in tribal form. The 21s and over today are much too old to get the TV tribal message of involvement. We are a lost generation, in that sense, expendable. But to come back for a moment to the 1920s, when those jazz babies reached the job plateau 10, 15 years later, they arrived with this total involved habit without any specialized directions or preferences of the old-fashioned, say, John Wayne variety, a man who knew exactly what he wanted. And when you put tribal man in a decision-making area, he quickly reveals his loss of direction, and you've got a slump, literally. When the man of visual direction and specialism is pushed aside by the electronic all-round, turned-on, swinging person, I got plenty of nothing, and nothing is plenty for me. Remember Porgy and Bess. That was the great message of the 20s. When those people reached the job plateau, we had a slump. But it's nothing compared to the slump that we're just about at another 5 years. The slump that's coming from the TV generation will be on a much greater scale unless we decide to operate. But the German world recovered direction and identity by violence, by war, and got into action, recovered itself, and I suppose the same war helped us to recover our sense of direction in spite of the jazz babies. But this kind of use of the airways or the total human environment as a teaching machine, a programmed teaching machine is what it has become. This extension of our own nervous system as a total environment of information is, in a sense, an extension of the evolutionary process. And instead of its taking place biologically over many thousands of years, it is now possible, in fact it has happened to us in the last few decades, it is now possible to traverse many millions of years in seconds by putting evolutionary extensions of ourselves outside as environments, as teaching machines. The man-made environments that are now planetary are, in terms of evolutionary development, a greater step than anything that ever happened to our biological lives in the whole biological past. Just because they are environments, they're invisible. This is a peculiarity. That's why, hence the meaning of that message to the fish, or the we don't know who discovered water, but we're sure it wasn't a fish. One thing that is always invisible to occupants is the environment. What stands out loud and clear is the old environment, the rearview mirror. So that to the TV operator, is the movie world is very visible. TV is invisible. The TV world is an X-ray world. TV is an X-ray device. The viewer of TV is being X-rayed at all times. The radiation goes right through them. The children get this message at once, and they carry the message out into the schoolroom where they find no resemblance to TV X-ray, where subjects are laid out in little classified forms, algebra and history and such. No depth, no involvement. So our children, our teeny boppers and the under 21s, utterly confused by the discrepancy between the environment they encounter as entertainment and the environment of the schoolroom. This confusion is on a bigger scale, if you like, repeated in the Vietnam business. Vietnam is getting the Western treatment. It's getting a thoroughly massive educational program. We put our whole mechanical industrial environment around them as an educational machine. This is what Julius Caesar did with the Huns. Alexander the Great did. War as an educational institution is the most powerful because it deals with the whole environment in action as an educational teaching machine. And somebody or other gets the message. But what we are doing in Vietnam is using the old 19th century machine program for the Orient. What we're doing to ourselves is orientalizing ourselves by our own latest technology. Instead of the outer trip, the inner trip. Instead of individual specialism, integral, organic involvement. The TV world and the world of electric circuitry automatically ensures the orientalizing of the whole of the human population exposed to it. Now, when the Negro experiences our new electric environment, he is turned on as never before. Black power just surges up as he feels this involvement and congenial hospitality of the electronic environment. And he looks around and he sees the old, literate, mechanical environment, which had always rejected him, degraded him, alienated him. And this naturally enrages him. He destroys it, if possible. The enemy. India and China and Africa will do this on a much bigger scale as soon as they encounter an electronic environment. Up till now, they're getting the 19th century, not the 20th. The 19th century was the old machine age of fragmentation, literacy, and specialism. The one that the liberal mind has never got beyond. It's never studied the later environment. It's literate, visual, detached, non-involved. The visual man is the only detached human being that ever lived on this planet. All the other senses except sight, smell, hearing, touch, movement, these are involving. And they are discontinuous and unconnected. Only the electronic permits a total encounter with the discontinuous and the disconnected. The world of the discontinuity came in most vividly with the telegraph and the newspaper. The stories in the newspaper are completely discontinuous because they're simultaneous. They're all under one dateline, but there's no storyline to connect them. TV is like that, of course. It's an X-ray mosaic screen with the light charging through the screen at the viewer. Joyce called it the charge of the light barricade. In fact, Finnegan's Wake is the greatest guide to the media ever devised on this planet and is a tremendous study of the action of all media upon the human psyche and sensorium. But it's difficult to read. But it's worth it. Now, as we move our evolutionary process out into the environment itself, and instead of putting something inside, Darwin thought of man as inside an environment. It never occurred to Darwin that it would be possible to program the environment itself as evolutionary. Darwin is a literate 19th century man, and never he had no intimation of the electronic information circuit or in total human environment of information. So Teilhard de Chardin is a little more aware of the meaning of the electronic than Darwin could possibly have been. But that's a perfect example of the rearview mirror, this Darwinian obsession with man's thumbs, fingers, and appendages as biological evolution. This had, right in the midst of the great evolutionary step into the electronic circuitry, Darwin remains obsessed with this content of this old environment. What we're, of course, saying here is that if man is now in a position to program the total human environment as a teaching machine for the first time in human history, he's also in a position to exercise some reasonable choice and preference over the programming of that environment, that rational man may really get his first innings out of this computerized universe. Up till now, he's been a kind of little straw blown around by the technologies. One of the reasons why we can now notice these environments generated by new technologies is that they yield to one another so rapidly that it's almost impossible not to notice the changing of the scene or the guard or something. But no previous human age ever understood the effect of these human endeavors on the environment as they affected that age. They always understood the effect on the previous age, but never the effect on themselves. The history of utopias is the history of rearview mirrors. Every utopia is a picture of the preceding age, like Bonanza Land. There is never a utopia that copes with the present, any present. Man seems to have this built-in device of rearview mirrorism because he fears this confrontation with the total human environment. The only person who seems to habitually encounter and report on the new present is the artist. And whenever he passes in his report, he is at once branded as a kook because the present is always unrecognizable because it is not safe to look at. When one understands the operation of these new environments on our human equipment, it then becomes easy to predict and forecast the changes that will take place in many levels of programming, of even of entertainment. The end of the star system is automatic with TV. The end of baseball, it's a star system, like prize fighting, won't work for TV. It's cool. It's involving. It doesn't permit the flashy, blazing, hot star to operate. The kids today are not interested in stars. The Smothers Brothers are not stars in the old sense at all, but The kids are very interested in the techniques used by the Smothered Brothers. They're very interested in the processes, how things are done and how things happened or do happen. This following of complex processes is part of the involvement need of an electric age. Expo in Montreal has been a great success for the simple reason that pulled the storyline off the whole show. Like a Fellini movie, no storyline. A storyline hots it up and leaves the spectator outside looking on helplessly without involvement. Expo is a mosaic without connections, just like page one. Total involvement results. Everybody wants to go back again and again to follow through this or that pavilion's activities. The New York World Fair, relative flop, too much storyline, too many connections, no room for involvement or participation. You can fill in from your experience with countless examples. But this happens to be the reason why the examples occurred. And Expo is exactly like the TV screen. It's a mosaic. It's not a picture. There are no pictures on TV. Even when you put a movie on TV, those are not pictures. It still comes through as a charge of the light barricade. It's an involving mosaic situation in which the storyline or connected spaces are not there. The viewer has to supply them. That's how he gets involved. However, I'm not trying to present any programs of action or any directions of action. I'm merely trying to suggest ways of perceiving the situation we have developed for ourselves. I have, as I listened to Ralph, I was recalled another communication story about the two Navajo Indians who were having a little chat across a Arizona Valley by smoke signal. And midway through their chat, the AEC released an atomic charge, and when the big mushroom cloud cleared away, one of the Indians sent up a little smoke signal to the effect, "Gee, I wish I'd said that." The world of communication stories is very rich. A sort of old-fashioned one is about the two goats at the back of a Hollywood studio, an old MGM studio, where there are masses of old throwaway film. And one of the goats kicked open a can containing a picture of Gone with the Wind. And having nibbled a bit, eagerly signaled to its companion to come on and get a bite of this. When the companion arrived and nibbled, the other one said, "How about it?" "Oh, I don't know. I think I like the book better." Media stories can be very useful, though, for studying media. And I heard one about the two mice in a nose cone moving around the planet. One says to the other, "How do you like this kind of work?" Another one says, "Oh, well, better than cancer research." You can see the grievances sticking out a mile. But good old Steve Allen and his observation. If jokes arise from grievances and irritation, then perhaps they serve as a release or catharsis of the same. I'm rather puzzled. I'm sure there's a reasonable cause. I haven't heard a story in the last, a funny story, since I came to New York 2 or 3 weeks ago. Just don't hear any. Ah, well, it isn't repeatable. That's my grievance for the day. But I have this uneasy feeling that I've released a number of these atomic charges. I'm predicting the next depression is not far off once our TV kids reach the job plateau. They don't want jobs. The next phase is the dropout executive. Oh, the reason for that is very simple. A big exec doesn't have a job, he has 60 jobs. That's a role. A mother doesn't have a job, she's 40 or 50 jobs, that's a role. In the electronic age where everything becomes associated, all activities become associated and interrelated, you can't have jobs, you can only have roles. So the whole job structure is a storyline that just, or an organization chart, just has to be yanked out if business is to survive. Yeah, the organization chart is as dead as baseball, and for the same reasons. One thing at a time. Baseball can't live in a TV age because there's one play at a time. One pitch, one hit, one catch won't work. In an all-at-once world, one thing at a time won't work on the job front or on the sports front. But or the educational front. Now, I'm trying to be helpful here. I'm not trying to just put on an act. I wish somebody had told me some of these things a few years ago. It's been exciting to discover them, but also I feel there's a bit of waste. For example, in the TV generation, there ought to be studies made, and heaven knows we're trying to do a few of them this year. There ought to be studies made of the difference between those who saw TV after they learned to read and write and those who first began to watch TV before they learned to read and write. I think you'll find there's a big watershed there. Two totally different kinds of human beings are coming on oncoming traffic. Two totally different kinds. The kids who learned to read and write before they saw TV had a kind of immunity, a cushion for their senses that made the TV impact very much less. And I think those exact dates and age groups ought to be carefully ascertained and studies made, because the whole future programming of work and education depends on it. Again, Vietnam is our first TV war. That's why people won't buy it. It's too involving. All the previous wars were fought on hot media like movies, pictures, our photographs, and press. And now people experience war as something that involves them profoundly. And they don't want to have anything to do with it. It isn't a question of trying to ascertain the pros and the cons, the rights and the wrongs of the Kong or whoever. That has nothing to do with it. It's just this new phase of total involvement and participation that is untakeable. So the new gang coming on, the kids who are really turned on, will find that war much less tolerable, or any other war, much less tolerable than the present generation. No comparison here. It seems to me that we do waste an awful lot of time assigning fanciful reasons for these events, and also in selecting very unfortunate and wasteful goals for our energies, when we do, after all, have a rather deep desire to work out a livable equilibrium for the human community. We do go to so much trouble to create violent upsets and disequilibrium. But I'm not sure how successful a reprogramming could be in our lifetime. I'm just going to check whether I have omitted some crucial funny stories. Probably not, but the none of them repeatable. I see one hint there. Columbus went too far. It's like that similar observation, Plymouth Rock should have landed on the Pilgrims. But in our present world, there cannot be a Columbus. External exploration has ended, and the future of exploration is necessarily internal, whether in medicine or in entertainment. So, since I feel you are in good humor at this moment, I think I will fold my tents like the Arabs and quietly steal off. Thank you very much.
Dr. McLuhan, you are a seer. Thank you very much, Doctor. And Dr. Ralph Baldwin, you've added immeasurably to our 2-day seminar, and we thank you.